Question. Don't forget, when you have spacecraft going up, in reality, like now you have two Russian Soyuz spacecraft attached to the International Space Station for emergency purposes and also for their ride home. Let me drop it. And each Soyuz spacecraft consists of three parts. You have your ascent and descent module, and that's the one in the center. And then you have your orbital module, that's up front. Then you have your service module with all the propulsion and water and air and a lot of your retro rockets, all in that section. So in the forward one and the orbital one, you also have a bathroom. So in reality, you have four bathrooms right now attached to the space station deck. Back to you.
Net.
Okay, yeah. Two of them are on the International Space Station, and I guess two are on Soyuz spacecraft. The space shuttle, I think it only had one. Maybe it had two. And there were times you've had as many as seven astronauts on the space shuttle with one bathroom. Sounds to me like that bathroom almost never gets a chance to cool off. Oh, you, LaPaul, K2IW.
Yeah, I know, you're right about that. And I think you have that book that shows the shuttle, all the different compartments, everything. I mean, everything from how it's hooked up to the boosters, to the external tank, to the inside of the shuttle, and all the controls and buttons. They also show where the bathroom is. I believe it was on the lower deck. They had three decks. They needed three decks. Let's say we're going to fly seven people. You'd have two up front by the pilot and co-pilot, and then you'd have another three behind him, behind them, and then another four behind that. And so you had one bathroom. I think it was on the port side. Space shuttle, they had the most you had was the return one time coming from space. I'll have to see which STS number this was, but there was one that came back. They actually came back with eight. They went up with seven and came back with eight. Some screwy thing happened there. Back to you there.
Eight astronauts on the space shuttle, and yes, I own the Space Shuttle Operator's Handbook. Both edition one and edition two. Lots of fold-out charts, lots of color diagrams, all kinds of schematics, lots and lots of information. But I'm pretty sure only one bathroom. Eight people on board. That sounds like a possible area of duress. But so you don't want to go to the Times Square during the New Year's Eve. Wow. I think you get close to a million people there, like you said, in a cage, all hooping and hollering. I guess one saving grace is that for security reasons, you're not allowed to bring an umbrella, you're not allowed to bring a great big container of any kind. And I think you're not allowed to bring any alcoholic beverages. So I think they restrict alcoholic beverages at Times Square during New Year's Eve. Am I right on that one, Paul? And that helps some. WS2N, K2IW. I bet your people smuggle some things in their pockets, though.
Yeah, I've heard no alcohol. I've heard the same thing many times. Whether they break that rule or not, who knows? Mostly young people. If there's a way to do it, I guess they'll do it. But yes, you will not find me there. Ever. And they say no alcohol on the platforms, when you get on the trains. You know. But, okay, one other thing I want to mention is the spacecraft that's still going around the last couple of years around Mars. And it's the one by India. And that's the, what is it? The Mars Orbiter Mission, I think they gave it that name. And then there's some long Indian name, I can't remember. That's been going around orbit, very highly elliptical orbit, for a couple of years now. Now they're going to have to readjust their orbit because of an eclipse in February. Surprisingly enough, it lasts a lot longer. They figured, well, they were going to be happy to get a year or two out of it. Now it looks like it's going to go maybe another 5 years. So they didn't look far enough ahead to realize that this February eclipse was coming, solar eclipse. So, you know, it's going to be dark, and it just so happens when it's coming, they're going to be at the high point of this highly elliptical orbit, and you know, they spend many, many hours going very slow on that particular part of the orbit, and they think with the eclipse, it could kill their batteries. They have a 50 amp power battery or something, but they're in the process now of readjusting their orbit to make sure it's not at that location when the eclipse comes. It's an interesting spacecraft. NASA actually got to put one of their radios on board. And they never thought they would use it as a relay for the rovers. But a month or so ago, they did test it in Curiosity Opportunity. I don't remember which one. One of the rovers that are on the Mars surface. As a test, they transmitted through, you know, up to MOM from India, and that in turn sent the signals back to the deep space network, and it worked perfect. In fact, they have a higher speed through that particular radio. It's more modern radio, they said, but this way it'll be alive and well in 2018, when we have another lander going there, Mars InSight, I think it's called, the Mars InSight. It's a lander, it's not a rover, so that'll be helpful. Because some of the other orbiters are getting very old, the ones that we have up there, and they're thinking about setting another orbiter. You know, NASA is. This is WS2M. Let me drop it. There's quite a few things going around Mars orbit now. And, you know, we have Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and it's the big one. And then you have Mars Odyssey. That one's been going since, what, 2001. It's still going. The European Space Agency has the Mars Express. And you have this other one from India, MOM. And now the United States, we sent up, what, a year or two ago, the MAVEN spacecraft. That's going around in orbit. That's also able to use that as a relay. And now even the United Arab Emirates are going to send up an orbiter probably 2020. They're looking to do that as well. So there's plenty of things going to be in orbit, and they'll be getting ready for another Curiosity type landing in 2020 as well. A lot of things are going to be going to Mars. China's planning on a lander. Even Japan is thinking about it, so very interesting. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
The total number of rovers on Mars, Curiosity is the great big one, the most recent one. All of a sudden, I'm having trouble remembering the names of the other ones, Paul. Refresh my memory on that.
The only other one that's working that we sent up is Opportunity. Spirit got stuck around, I guess, 2000. I think they got 6 years out of it, so they landed 2004. So that's got stuck around 2010, 2011. Back to you.
Spirit got stuck and it can no longer move. It's dug into the sand, and I think one of its wheels is not turning, which is aggravating the situation. However, is it still getting sunlight? Is it still making some measurements, to your knowledge?
They lost contact eventually with it, so it got stuck in a bad place, and it got so cold that batteries depleted to the point of no return. So solar panels are not facing in the proper direction, and they haven't made contact with it in probably 6 years now, I guess. Back to you there.
Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity. The solar cells on the first two rovers, because I don't think they were nuclear powered, have to supply the battery charging. The charging of the battery maintains the heater at the Mars night. Mars night goes down to some ridiculous cold temperature like minus 150 centigrade. So is the drain of the batteries maintaining the heater for the Martian night, Martian winter, and is that heater also keeping the batteries above a certain temperature? Are the batteries doing their own heating, putting out power to do their own heating, Paul, because the batteries cannot tolerate the full Martian winter night, WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I think they had 400 watt capability when they landed, and then they kept getting dusty, and they would drop down significantly, sometimes at half. But now, you know, once in a while you get a little windstorm and it blows all the dust off, and you take pictures of the you can take pictures of itself, and you can see that the panels are perfectly clean. And last I heard, Opportunity has more power now than almost when it when it first started. So that's doing good. And as far as heat, they have some of the power is used for heat, but main heat is coming from like a plutonium giving off heat inside the web, inside the warm electronic box. And they had that system first with Pathfinder. Well, Pathfinder had a rover with it called Sojourner. Sojourner had that same type of thing just to keep the electronics warm. And so it supplemented electric heating for the for the batteries. It's not an RTG, it's not a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, it's just, some form of uranium. I think it's 239. And they look like they're about the size of a D-cell, a couple of them. And that's what tends to keep it warm. Back to you there.
Curiosity is the most recent one with the RTG. It's approximately I think it's almost the size of a Volkswagen. Pretty heavy. I vaguely remember that one of the wheels has developed some holes where going over rocks it created metal fatigue of some of the rim of that wheel. And I think also one of the sensors on the mast, was it an acoustic sensor or a solar sensor? One of the sensors failed. But sounds to me like that had very few failures on Curiosity. Is that true? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah. It was a bit of an international effort, too. The Russians supplied some kind of a radio to look through the ground, to look a meter or two below the ground to see if they could detect any water or water ice. The detector on the bed was part of the weather system, and that was from Spain. Spain sent the weather instruments. So I think that's one of the detectors that had a problem. But they're doing good without it. And something else you said. I know it's a rover with the RTG on it. But I don't know. There was another question involved. Oh, the wheels. I know what it was, the wheels. Yeah, if you look at the wheels, there's little good-sized holes and dented up pretty good. As it was driving from, through the crater to go to Mount Sharp the first couple of years, the weight of this thing, even though it's 2,000 pounds on Earth, 3/8 of that on Mars, but it's still enough to put holes in the wheels from sharp type of rocks when we drop it. So they're being a little bit more careful when they send it out. They don't just say point it in one direction and say let's go. They're very careful with satellites above, and then they. They'll take a lot more pictures before the Curiosity starts moving. They don't want to make those wheels any worse. And if you look at the wheels, it looks like it has a lot more holes in it than it really does. But what you're really looking at is Morse code on the wheels. You can see on the wheels it says JPL. It's got these holes, and it's actually there for a reason. They thought of this. They said, we should put holes in the wheels so that when we roll and we take pictures, in case some of our meters aren't working, we'll be able to look at the ground, and we'll be able to see JPL, and we'll know if it's a P or a J, and how many feet we rolled when we drop it.
So they're literally counting revolutions of that wheel by looking at the marks left on the ground. Back to you.
Yes, exactly. And when you look at the wheels up close, these wheels are like probably 30 inches high in diameter. It's big wheels. When you look at them up close, you see these big holes in the wheels. So if you roll it to one point, you see the J, and then maybe about 8 inches later, you see the... and then see further down the line. And they like it so much that on a new Curiosity that goes up, they're not calling it Curiosity, the new rover, they call it right now the 2020 rover. Mars rover is going to have the same kind of wheels with JPL on them. But my guess is they'll probably be better wheels, probably be more reinforced. Another thing they want to send on the new rover is a helicopter. It's going to fly out ahead, take pictures. They'll really know what's ahead before they start rolling. And they'll be able to use the helicopter every day. Back to you, Dick.
Between Spirit and Opportunity, one of them is stuck in the mud, so to speak. It's really stuck in the sand with a stuck wheel, and it's going dead. Is the other one still moving around, and is there a staff giving it commands from time to time? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, Opportunity is still on the move. Oh, yeah. And it's broken some kind of record for driving off planet. I think the record was by the Russians on the moon. I don't know, 20, I think they had I guess 24 miles or something. An Opportunity is actually broken that. But, it's taken it, what are we up to now, 13 years. It landed January 3rd, and then the other one 2 weeks later. Spirit landed first, and then Opportunity, beginning of January of 2004. So in that time, it's gone like 27 miles. So it's still going. They go from crater to crater. They'll spend like a year or two, and sometimes more, in a crater. I think active record is 3 or 4 years in the Endurance crater. Back to you, Dick.
Has NASA made a prediction as to how long Curiosity will keep going? As long as they can keep their funding to keep the staff from giving it commands. So Curiosity, roughly how many years do they think they're going to get out of it? Roughly how many miles has it traveled so far, or kilometers, over the UFO?
Yeah, I forgot what the odometer is. I think they're up to 6 miles or something, maybe more. Landed, what, August 2012. So, you know, we're into, what, 4 or 5 years? Well, yeah, this August will be 5 years. And they wanted to get over 2 years, you know. The mission is for 2 years. Anything else is gravy. Spirit and Opportunity was 3 months. They were shooting for 3 months. After that, they were, you know, thank goodness this is going to be good. Well, 3 months turned into, what are we up to? 13 years, I guess, so far for Opportunity. Back to you, Dick.
Are all the wheels turning on Opportunity, Paul?
Yeah, that one's doing good. Yeah, you remember Spirit, you know, that had the broken front wheel. So they thought it would be a good idea to drive backwards for forever. Drive backwards. And just drag that one wheel. And they did that for, I guess, a couple of years. Which came in handy because one time they, you know, because it was dragging, they dug up some dirt and they found some ice underneath it when they took pictures. They could see this white substance. So they rolled back and confirmed that it was ice. So actually having a broken wheel gave them a big success for the science people. Back to you, Dick.
Do I remember that non-turning wheel? I guess we're talking about the Spirit, a front wheel, because it couldn't turn, or it could turn, but with a grinding motion, and it used up a lot of electrical power. So rather than force it to run, they fixed that wheel, made the thing run backwards, made everything back up. By dragging that wheel, it took some of the red surface Mars soil, dug through it, and you saw white stuff underneath. And I wasn't aware that the white stuff underneath was confirmed to be, what, frozen water, water vapor, brackish water. I don't know whether or not Spirit had enough hardware on board to analyze the water. Probably Curiosity would be able to analyze the water and tell you its saline content. Is that true, Paul? WS2N? And by the way, has Curiosity also found water that has analyzed? You got it, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, well, they've detected. They know that wherever Curiosity is going, they're able to detect what's below the surface. But I don't think they dug anything up with Curiosity to confirm it was ice. And I'll have to check. They definitely did that with the Phoenix mission. You might remember the Phoenix mission. That was, what, 2007. That landed toward the northern latitudes of Mars, and that had a big scoop on it. What didn't have any wheels. It had three legs that came out when it landed. It saved one place with a big scoop, and that was the one where they scooped some dirt out, and they looked at it, and they could see that, you know, the shiny stuff was what they believed was ice. And the way they confirmed that, you know, I thought they were going to dig it up and, you know, boil it or something, but the way they confirmed it was the next day it was gone. It evaporated. So they have before and after pictures. That was the Phoenix mission. Of course, that stopped working after 2 years, a little less than 2 years, because it was in the northern latitude, got covered up eventually with frozen carbon dioxide. K2RIWWS.
Is that one operating on solar cells, and the solar cells got covered up with frozen carbon dioxide, no RTG on board? Is that why that one failed?
Yes, they knew that, and because it was in the northern latitudes, they knew exactly about when it was going to happen to. Now, they're copying that design for InSight, but InSight's going to be more of an equatorial type of landing. That one will probably keep on going. And that's the one with seismometers on there, some kind of a big drill that's going to dig into the ground. That should be good. One of them, I don't know if it's the next rover that they're sending or the InSight is going to have a microphone so you can hear things moving, you know. You can hear the actuators going and all. That would be pretty good. I always wanted to hear that. They tried it on one of the missions, but it failed. I think they had it on Curiosity. I don't think it worked. One of them. I think the best thing, though, for 2020 is going to be the helicopter. It's going to recharge. It's going to be operating on solar panels. It's going to be big blades. And it's going to spin at some ridiculous speed because you have very thin atmosphere there. It's going to fly off, take pictures, land, recharge. Be able to fly like a minute or two per day. Back to you, Dave.
So you're telling me that the Rover 2020 is going to have a drone on board, and that drone is going to be programmed and commanded from the Rover 2020. It's going to go out and take pictures and by radio signals send them back to the Rover, which in turn sends them back to NASA. Wow. And I can think of a zillion ways that you can get a failure of that drone, that helicopter. Maybe it's a quadcopter, maybe it's a hexacopter. I can think of a zillion ways you can get a failure of it. And I guess you could always drive the rover over there and with its scoop, pick it up, dust it off. if it lands upside down, you right it. And so the rover could fix it in some cases. Is that true, Paul? Is it a quadcopter or a hexacopter? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it looks like it's just got the two blades on top, you know, they spin opposite one another, that type of thing. Not a typical drone like, you know, what we see with the four different blade locations. That's what I thought they were going to do when I first heard it, but saw a guy being interviewed at NASA. He was with JPL. He was talking about all the different things that were involved. He talked about the speed of the rotor blades. I forgot what it was, but they also pretty long. I mean, you've got to be able to pick up some kind of air, and the air is only like one-tenth of 1% of what we have here or something like that. So they've tested it already. They put it into this big chamber and brought it down to near vacuum, and it's just going to duplicate the pressure that they have on Mars. And he's worried about radiation affecting this thing. And he's worried about the ultraviolet rays eventually. He's got all these things he's got to think about to try to, not just going to, you know, go down to the toy store and buy a helicopter, you know. He wants the camera to last. And the landing is so important. He's got a. Looks like there were four landing legs on there. So, that's the biggest worry. He's going to land this every day and not break it. Back to you, Dave.
I seem to remember the air pressure on Mars is 0.7% of the air we've got on Earth. If that's true, it's 143 times more tenuous than air on Earth. helicopter blade is really a rotary wing. The amount of lift you get out of the rotary wing is a function of velocity squared. So if you can move those blades on the helicopter, square root of 142 is approximately 12. If you can move the RPM of the helicopter blades 12 times faster, and maybe a little bit bigger in area than on the Earth, then in theory you can develop the same amount of lift and horsepower required. It's going to take 140 times more horsepower. So a horsepower required is either square law or a cube law of rotation. So I can see how a full charge on the batteries, let me drop it. A full charge on the batteries of the helicopter move the blades 12 times higher in RPM. In theory, you can develop the same amount of lift as a helicopter on Earth. It's pushing the state of the art, but it sounds possible. But man, with those velocity of those blades, if something goes wrong and they strike the ground, unless they're made out of really rugged stuff, they're going to shatter. Did they go into any of the specifics that I just mentioned, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
No, not really. Outside of telling you that they've flown it many times inside this vacuum chamber. It's been Ohio someplace. They have a big vacuum chamber. So, we'll see. I hope it makes it in, you know, I heard that it's going to make it into the program, but you never know. You know, if they run into complications like you're talking about, then they might not have it ready by 2020. You know, they have to have a location on the rover for it, be able to deploy this thing. And how do you deploy it? You got all kinds of things sticking out of the rover after it lands. You gotta hope that the blades are not gonna hit the mast or the camera. I think they have a lot to think about. Or maybe what they're gonna do is pop it out of the rover like a jack in a box, and they'll use the arm like you were saying before. Take the arm, put this thing far enough away from the rover, and then let it take off. And then when I heard it was solar powered, I was wondering how they were gonna do that. And when I looked close at the rover that he was using, he pointed to the solar panel. It's a round disc, good size round disc. I don't know how many inches in diameter it was, but it's sitting on top of the rotor. You know, so the rotor's spinning below this thing somehow. Maybe I can't imagine how they're doing this, because the panel is spinning with the rotor. Well, they have some kind of contacts coming off or going into the battery to recharge it. That is what I like to see.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What does the rover buy you that you don't get without the rover, other than an aerial view, which is interesting? I'm having trouble believing that an aerial view is going to allow you from a rover, from a helicopter, to find things you wouldn't ordinarily find by scooting around with your rover. That's question number one. And question number two, this helicopter is going to be on Rover 2020, or Lander 2020, whatever you're going to call it. And there's something earlier that's going to go there, which has seismic capability. I've forgotten the name of this other thing that's going to land on Mars. It's going to have seismic capability. Run that by again, Paul. K2RAW.
Yes, that's InSight. And the interview, they were talking to this guy from JPL. They said, suppose we're here, and they're standing in this one location. You know, we can see around here, but we can't see. We have a rise over here. It's about 10 feet, and they showed a helicopter takes off. And now they can see what's up there, if there's anything interesting that they want to look at. You know, or if they're looking for a safe way to get around, they could use this helicopter. It would be a lot faster than waiting for satellite pictures. You know, of course, if you're going to get better pictures from this helicopter, which is only, 20 feet off the ground. whatever it is. So, Insight is the other one. That was supposed to go up in 2016, last year actually now. But because of Kness is the French space agency that was building a component, let me drop it. Building his vacuum chamber for the seismometer. It's building this vacuum chamber. It was made out of titanium. It's like a titanium tank. And whatever they were doing, they couldn't hold the vacuum. They need like a pure, perfect vacuum. And they couldn't get it in time for the launch of 2016. So they have to wait for the next window, which is now 2018. And JPL took over. They took it away from Kness. And Kness is CNES, that's the French space agency. They took the job away from them, and now JPL has done it. They've succeeded, and that's why they know that Insight is the name of the spacecraft that will be going up in 2018. Back to you.
Now, what does Insight have that we haven't seen before? Is Insight a rover? I think you said it's got seismic capability. And I'm also disappointed that a lot of these missions didn't have a microphone on board. I would get great thrill out of hearing that whistling wind. I believe the wind on Mars at times moves 300 or 400 miles an hour. So, is Insight a rover? What all can it do that we haven't seen before? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, the Mars Polar Land had a microphone, but never followed that story. That was the one that actually crashed into the planet. It didn't work out for us. During that same window opportunity, we also lost the Mars Climate Orbiter. And that one failed during the same window. We lost two of them. So, yeah, we thought we were going to hear noises from the Mars Polar Lander. Insight is just a lander, but it's got I think that one's got a microphone on board, and it has a big drill which can drill like 6 feet into the ground, and it's got seismometers on there, and really supposed to detect a lot of things that are within inside the Mars, deep inside the surface of Mars. All the equipment is dedicated for that. Don't ask me, what kind of sensors or anything are involved, how they work. I don't know that, but I know the geologists are really into this Insight mission. Back to you, sir.
I seem to remember that the ALSA packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package, ALSET, they had a seismometer. And I believe they found out that when a good-sized rock hits the moon rings like a bell for many minutes downrange, and the sound bounces around inside of the moon. And I guess Mars is halfway between moon and Earth, so seismometer-wise, it could be kind of interesting. A 6-foot hole in the ground with seismometer and microphone. Are there any other kinds of scopes and arms on Insight? WS2N, K2RIW.
You got a claw. It's going to be able to actually grab the hull of this one thing that was leaking, and they're going to, JPL fixed. They're going to take this thing and move it away from the spacecraft with this arm. And it probably has some kind of scoop and chemistry tester or something on board, I would think, but I don't know. But it definitely has an arm and a claw. And probably some kind of digging scoop. So we'll see. We got 2 years to cover that one. I started to cover it originally a couple of years ago, but since it was delayed now, doesn't pay to revisit that. So A lot of things are going to happen in 2018 with Mars. You know, the European Space Agency wanted to send their rover in 2018, but that's not going to be ready. So they're not going to send that in 2020. But 2018, we'll see if SpaceX does what they want to do. They want to take a Dragon crewed vehicle, similar to what you would have people in, and land this thing without it, just going to be propulsive landing all the way down to the ground. You're going to, that's his plan. But with all the problems that he's had recently, I don't know if he's going to make that. But he's sure going to try. So that'll be also 2018. Back to you, Dick.
I think it's late in 2018 when the big infrared telescope, I can't think of the name of that one. I keep forgetting the name of it.
James Webb.
So on, James Webb. Is that still on schedule for something like October 2018 launch? And I'm guessing it takes a good fraction of a year to get on station and get the testing. Go ahead.
Yeah, that'll be, like you said, probably October 2018. And that's on schedule, although they have had some problems about a month or two ago. They took the whole setup and put it into a chamber and started vibrating, and the machine shut itself down. One of the accelerometers detected some kind of vibration that shouldn't be there. So whatever the end results are, I haven't really heard yet, but they said that they figured out that there was no damage done to James Webb. So I guess they're going to fix whatever vibration was taking place and then retest it. And the question was, is this going to delay the launch? And they said no. They figured this in. They figured if there was going to be problems, this was one of the first problems that creeped up. They figured it was going to be okay for the timeline that they have, and that will be launched from French Guiana, Kourou, with the Ariane 5 rocket. So that should be good. And how long is it going to take? I think before it starts sending back real pictures after to calibrate everything, it's got to take at least a couple of months, I would think. Back to you, Dave.
I don't know if you've ever worked for an environmental testing laboratory. I haven't, but I visited them. And there was a special environmental testing laboratory that was connected to Airborne Instruments Laboratory during the, 35 years that I worked there. What you do when you're doing a vibration test of a new piece of instrumentation is you put accelerometers on it all over the place, connect them up electronically. They're really tiny little direct contact loudspeakers, so to speak, or microphones. And you slowly, you decide how many G's you're going to vibrate your item at. You mount it on this huge loudspeaker that doesn't have a cone to it. It's a huge magnetic coil. And you shake it at a given number of G's, usually with a sine wave. And you sweep that sine wave, starting at a low frequency, and you're slowly sweeping it upward. What you're looking for is a mechanical resonance. If one of your accelerometers starts going into a peak, you know it's connected to something that is resonating at that frequency. Because the shake, rattle, and roll of the rocket engine going through the atmosphere gives very predictable amplitudes and frequencies of vibration, X number of G's. And so you sweep your loudspeaker connected to your item under test, looking for resonance. Resonance is bad because at resonance, the vibration builds up to a very large magnitude, which is capable of causing destruction. It can snap. It can break things. So when you start seeing resonance, you stop the test, analyze what's resonating, and do whatever's required. Put on dampers, change the mass, lighten it, heavy it, add more bracing, do whatever required to get rid of the resonance. I am guessing that's what they saw on James Webb. They were sweeping it on a shake table, and they saw the beginning of a resonance take place, and rather carrying that through to destruction, they said, hey, the amount of the resonance we're getting to the threshold where damage could occur. Let's stop and fix it. I think that's what might have happened. Does it sound approximately right, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
I never worked in a place like that, but from what I understand, the accelerometer that showed it went, you know, beyond its limits to, you know, whatever part it was on, I don't know. But they do have a lot of them all over. And not only is it being shooken, they have the speakers all over. And you know, who knows how many dB noise or what frequency is coming out of these speakers, but it's supposed to duplicate the sound of the launch. Because the sound of the launch itself creates vibrations. You know, it's not only the thrust of the rocket, especially when it starts to go through maximum Q. Maximum Q is, you know, higher up in the atmosphere, usually about 70 seconds or so into the atmosphere. And you would think that you're going higher into the atmosphere is going to get thinner. You're not going to have that much pressure on the outside of the rocket, but you actually have a lot more because now the rocket is moving faster and faster. So, you know, if you had a graph that would intersect, you know, the speed of the rocket is increasing as it goes up, and even so, the pressure of the air is going down. At some point, usually about a little over a minute, those two factors come into play where that's the most pressure on a vehicle as it's going up. They call that maximum Q. So they're trying to duplicate that in a factory setting. They overdo it. I know they overdo it this way. They know that if it works with the test on Earth, it should be able to work and survive a launch. WS1.
Yeah, the maximum G's you can get out of a wing, the maximum amount of lift, is a function of velocity squared and the area of the wing and the density of the air and so on. So because you're building up velocity real fast, that starts dominating, even though the air is getting thinner up there. You're moving so fast that the maximum G's, if you're going through rough air, can build up to a pretty big number. If you're on a commercial airliner and you're flying at maximum speed, maximum altitude, and if you happen to be going through very rough air, you can either keep going at that speed and hope you don't break a wing or damage or injure the passengers, or you can slow down the plane. They do slow down the plane. When the plane is moving slower, you get to the point where the maximum lift the wing can generate is limited. If the air you're going through is so rough that it would have buffeted your airplane at, 5 G's, so to speak, 3 G's, the wing will literally go into a stall when you're flying slow enough, and so that impact of running into that puff of air is lessened. So in very rough air, they slow down the plane. Don't worry so much about the fact you're going to be arriving late because you had to go slower. A really sad situation was that French airplane that fell into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Let me drop it. They hadn't upgraded the pitot tubes, the velocity indicators, with a better heater. They were supposed to do that and hadn't done it. The pitot tube iced over. The automatic pilot had no way of knowing how fast the plane is flying. It tripped out. The pilot had to take over. He's in a thunderstorm at night over the Pacific Ocean. He's got no way to see the horizon. He doesn't trust his instrumentation because he's got no way of knowing how fast he's moving because the pitot tube was iced over. Foolishly, he kept pulling back on the stick because he wanted to make sure he was not sinking. He wanted to be climbing. because he had no indication of what speed he was flying, he literally stalled the airplane at a very high altitude and stalled it all the way into the water. What a waste, if you know what I mean. There's a procedure you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go to something like a 80% thrust of the engine with a certain amount of up elevator in order to make sure that you are flying, even though you can't see the horizon, even though you don't know what the speed is. He was throttling back on the engine, using a lot of up elevator, didn't know the speed, couldn't see the horizon. He had another indication when you listened to the audio recording in the cockpit. He was complaining about that the control surfaces were not responding. He could pull back and push forward on the controls, and he wasn't feeling the airplane doing anything. That's a strong indication that he was flying much too slowly. He was not getting enough authority. He had a lot of clues. He just wasn't properly trained for that environment. And so, 225 people died. It took them a month of Sundays to recover all that aircraft from the deep Atlantic Ocean to try to find out what happened. Remember that incident?
Repeater, time out.
Remember that incident, Paul? They were flying from, I think, Rio de Janeiro back to France, going across the Atlantic Ocean in a really rough thunderstorm. WS2N, K2LAW.
It's about, but it must have been quite a while ago. But it's similar to the rockets, you know. They all throttle down. They all throttle down as they get to maximum Q. That's why they all, you know, that's one of the good things with the liquid engines. They're throttleable. You could, like, put a shuttle. You know, you had three RS-25 engines going. So they would throttle down and then throttle back up, you know. You'd hear the call, throttle up, go and throttle up. You know, then they'd go back up to 100%. But if they didn't do that, two things could happen. Either you could create some damage to the vehicle, or the G's would be also too much for the passengers. But you need to have some kind of throttleable system. You always hear them talk about maximum Q on every launch. If you listen to these guys, they're very good, but, you know, a lot of people don't know what they're talking about. Back to you, Dick.
From what I've read, that shuttle launch is a very rough ride. The portions of the ride in which you're being shaken to a degree where people literally thought that the teeth were going to come out of their mouth, and they're not wearing false teeth. It's one hell of a rough ride. I guess it's a little bit dependent on the weather, but it's not a nice, easy launch, as I understand it. I wonder if you've read any of those descriptions of Paul, K2IW.
I've heard that, but, you know, I've also seen pictures of the launch. You really don't, you know, don't know what they're feeling as you're watching it. Lately with the Soyuz launches, they all look like they're very calm going uphill. The only time there's any kind of a jerk is, and they have live TV. They're doing very good with Soyuz, and you know, you watch them sitting there, and the only time there's any kind of a jolt or a jerk is when they start the third stage. They have a hot stage startup too. The stage actually starts up before the separation of the booster. Strange way of doing it, but that's the way they do it. Back to you, Dick.
Why does the rocket engine on the third stage start firing before you have disconnected from the second stage? Is that the poor man's separation spring, so to speak, Paul? And, boy, that timing has got to be really careful. I presume you're exploding explosive bolts to do that separation. And if that engine is cranking away and those bolts don't fire at the right time, I suspect you can do some pretty nasty damage. K2LAW.
Yeah, I know, but they've launched like, I don't know, 1,500 of these type of rockets, Soyuz rockets, different variations of them, all the same way. And if you bring up the Soyuz rocket on a launch pad before they go up, daytime, and zoom in on it, you can see that, let's say there's a blue sky behind it, you can see between the stages the blue sky. It's open, you know, they have big struts connecting the two. If you look for that, it's very interesting, and they need that for that reason. And yeah, it is the exhaust of that stage actually pushes the other one away. Where we separate a stage, they'll put a little sometimes nitrogen rockets like SpaceX uses. They're called Ullage rockets. They'll push that lower stage away as it separates. Back to you, Dick.
Juno, I think, is the spacecraft that's going around Jupiter at very low altitude. I believe a blast of Van Allen Belt radiation upset the computer, and it had to be restarted. And I think they delayed one of the rocket firings. In the 3 minutes we got left, what's the latest on Juno, Paul? If I got this right, spacecraft. WS2N, K2IW.
Okay, Juno is around polar orbit around Jupiter. And the problem was with the check valve and the fuel line. And they're afraid to use it. It's not opening and closing as quickly as they would like it to. And they're afraid of a fault, so rather than go into the 14-day orbit that they planned, they're going to stay with the 53-day orbit and just extend the mission. They're still coming in as close as they would like, but they would have liked to have done it every 14 days instead of every 53 days. So they're going to leave it like this unless they work out, you know, some kind of a problem to clear up the fuel line situation, and I haven't heard of a problem yet with the computers. I think there was a problem, but I don't know if it was related to the radiation, where they switched over from one computer to the other. They have a backup system. And yeah, we're running out of time, so hang on to your newspaper tomorrow, Dick, and look it up. And when you see the name Jennifer in there, that's my daughter. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'll be looking for that. I think they said the computer detected a major failure, a major fault, and it went into the safe mode and didn't communicate for a while, and then they got a chance to reboot it on Juno. I vaguely remember reading something along those lines. As I was cleaning up some magazines that I've got from the year one, like 2005, I ran into some, I think it was the Discovery magazine or Popular Science, I think it was Discovery. Discovery way back in 2005 had a 17-page article with photographs and diagrams of the total Russian space program, what goes on at Baikonur and all the other places. I've torn out those pages. I'll be mailing them to you. Maybe you've already seen it. I don't know. But as I said, 17 consecutive pages on the Russian space program. Looked like a lot of data in there. This was TechNet number 1,636. Space report number 236. Yeah, 236. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week, and we're going to settle all these issues, it says here. Thank you, Paul, K2LAW.
Real good. Thanks for that, Dick. And then since then, they've opened up a new launch complex, which they're going to be using more often as the years go up by. Right now, they've only launched one rocket from it so far, but that'll be their main launch facility for everything, everything to do with astronauts and that type of thing. Voskochny, they call it, on the eastern end of, far eastern end of Russian soil. So, 73 deck. Everybody else will be back next week. Have a good week.